Okay.
So welcome to lecture 10. So we're going to be talking about control flow today. We talked about memory yesterday, with the last lecture. And so by this time, you know, you should have a pretty good understanding of how registers actually work. And when you declare a local automatic variable, you know, what's going to happen. And eventually we would also show some PTX, you know, a code, and probably have John to do a little demo or something about PTX so that you can get a better feeling of how to, you know, get a, you know, picture of the register usage. We talk about shared memory, constant memory. So all these things should make the declarations of variables a lot more concrete at this point, you know, so that you can think about them. So I'm going to spend a lecture on how the control flow, that is decisions in your code, actually works in hardware. And this is also a somewhat confusing part. You know, most CUDA programmers actually kind of understand it, and then, you know, trip on things, and, you know, actually doing some optimizations that may even be hazardous. So, you know what, over time we accumulated some of these things, and so, you know, we're going to spend some time talking through them. So the objective here is, first of all, to understand the branch divergence overhead. Okay, what is really, you know, going on with branch divergence, and, you know, how do you make sure that you actually make good use of the execution resources when you need to have control flow. And oftentimes, especially in some of the basic algorithms, you can actually shift things around and change your algorithm slightly to avoid control flow divergence. Fundamentally, you cannot avoid decision, but you can make decisions in a way that does not impact the performance as much. So that's kind of, you know, what we're going to be talking about. And we also want to understand the compiler hardware, you know, what predication design to reduce the impact. There are certain things that you can actually do to help the compiler to take away some of the pain as well. So, you know what, we're going to talk about you know, how that works. Some terminologies. You know what, you would, by this time you should feel that this is a repetition, okay, and then it is. And the reason why there's repetition is, oftentimes we found out that you know, by the time you really get to your code and so on, and you know, sometimes the terminology still needs to be refreshed a couple times for, you know, for you to really you know, become your real second nature. So threads is concurrent code, and they all come from the same kernel, right? And they're associated with state executed on CUDA device. And when you launch a kernel, you have a bunch of these threads, and every one of them have their own registers, right? And all the ones in the block will have shared memory access, and so on. A warp is a group of threads executed physically in parallel, okay? So these warps are chopped up from the thread blocks, okay? And then you take these warps, and the threads in those warps are the true parallel execution units, okay, in the CUDA thread structure. So those 32 threads will always on and off at the same time, and they will be doing things in a concurrent, always concurrently, right, with each other. Block is really a way of allocating resource in the model, okay? So whenever you have a block of threads, this block of threads move around in the machine, you know, gets assigned into one of the SAMs, right? And they, you know what, they get resources, and, you know what, eventually they do synchronization, and eventually the entire block gets completed and move out of the way. A grid is really all the threads, the collection of all the threads that you create by calling a kernel. And all these threads have to complete before the next kernel call can take place. Okay, so you know what? So now, to understand how control flow actually works, you really need to have a really good understanding of how the warps are really, you know what, formed. So, you know what, as we mentioned before, thread blocks are really partitioned into these warps, and you use the thread IDs, right? They're thread IDs to make that decision. So all the thread IDs within a warp are consecutive and increasing. So, you know, 0 to 31, one warp. 32 through 63, one warp. And if you have, you know what, two-dimensional or three-dimensional, you know what, blocks, you linearize it. And you know what, you take the X and then the Y and the Z, just like the memory layout. And then you take 32, 32, 32. So, you know, the partition is actually, the policy of partitioning is always the same. Meaning that, you know, the thread IDs are always consecutive, okay? And they're always increasing. But the warp size, whether it's 32 or 16 or 64, that could change over the implementation, across the implementations. So you can use the knowledge to, you know, in control flow, but the exact size cannot be assumed. And so when you write a piece of code, you can actually use the size to argue about the performance degradation and how far you're willing to go in kind of adjusting your algorithm to avoid performance degradation. But when you make that adjustment, make sure you don't rely on this warp size in terms of correctness. And I'm going to give you one example to, you know, to show you how the performance optimization versus correctness work. So, you know what, another important thing is do not rely on any ordering between the warps. So if there's any kind of dependence, you know what, between threads, even within the same warp, you should not assume that, oh, all these warps are going to be executed truly in parallel. And I know exactly they were going to be executing the same instruction at any time, and therefore I can assume that I don't need to synchronize between these threads because they are executed in synchrony, right? They're marching at the same speed. Don't assume that. It may work in one machine. As soon as you port the code to another machine, when the warp size changes, things start to fall apart. Okay, so sure, but you don't make that kind of assumption. So those are the threads. And you know, we already talked about all those concepts. So you know what, it should be a fairly easy review, but now I'm going to relate those concepts into your, you know, into the if statements and loops and so on in your, yes, Wally?
The only reason for threads executing out of sync is because of change in rope size.
Yeah, so the question is the only reason why these threads in a warp can go out of sync is because of the change of warp size? As far as I can tell, yes.
Okay.
So, so let's talk about, control flow. So what is control flow? Control flow is really, you know, any time in your code that you're going to make some kind of decision. And you know what, these decisions can be more obvious, can be less obvious. For example, the most obvious one is if you have an if then else. Okay, so in your code, you say, I have a, you know what, if the variable is greater than zero, I do certain things. If it's less than zero, I do certain things. If my bank account is positive, I go out to eat tonight. If my bank account is negative, I don't eat. Right. So, you know what, there are different decisions you can make to, you know, according to the variable values. And there are also a little less obvious control flow and, you know what, loops, right? So, you know what, if you think about loops and say, okay, you know what, I'm going to have a for loop and it's going to loop over, you know what, 32, you know what, array elements. And that's a control flow. Okay, and you know, at every end of every iteration, you make a decision whether you want to go back to the previous one, right? And you also have while loops. And these while loops, you know, are a little bit less, you know, structured in the sense that you may do certain things and then you look at, you know what, your state and say, while there's still, animals, or no, not animals, that's not good. Monsters to kill, you know, I will continue to loop around, and, you know, so that's a video game, right? So, you know, there's some of these things that, you know, you're going to actually have to take these iterations, do things until, you know, you reach a point where you say, oh, I'm getting, you know, I killed too many monsters, you know, from the elevator, from the helicopter or something. So then, you know, stop, right? So there are various degrees of decisions that you tend to make in your code. And some of them are going to be very obvious in terms of control divergence, and some of them will be more subtle. Okay, so that's why I want you to, you know, to think about this control flow in a broader sense in your code. So the main concern with branching, you know, all these things in the traditional machine have been implemented with conditional branches. Okay, so basically you execute that instruction. If the condition is met, you branch to some place. If not, then you continue. So that allows you to do, you know, two different activities. You know, when you go down a single path. So these different execution paths in GAD, or in most all the CUDA processors that hardware implementation that I am aware of, always will be serialized, meaning that if you execute your kernel and it reaches the if then else, so you have the then part, you have the else part. If you have threads in a block, okay, and actually threads in a warp, and some of the threads are going to, you know, are going to see the array values that will lead them into the then part, and some of them will see the array values that will lead them to the else part, then the hardware will do the following. The hardware will actually say all the threads execute the then part. Okay, maybe all the threads execute the else part. It doesn't matter. Okay, so one way or the other. And so all the threads execute, let's say, the then part. But the hardware makes sure that all the threads who wanted to go to the else part will actually just kind of not change their execution state. Okay, so you know what? They participate, but they don't really take effect. Okay, so they just kind of go along, but they don't end up making changes to their variables. Okay, and then the hardware would go to the else part. All the threads will now fetch instruction from the else part, and they will all execute again, but the ones that wanted to take them part would not make changes to their state. So by the time you're done, you know, with both paths, the then part instructions would have taken their effect during that first pass, and the else part will take effect during the second pass. So this is the reason why it can be very expensive. If you start to think about nested if then else, then you start to have, you know, every nesting level gives you another two multiplicative, you know, a multiplying effect, right, to the number of paths that you want to take. So let me do a little bit experiment. Okay, let me do a little bit experiment here, you know, just kind of to demonstrate the effect here. So you know what, in the first step, okay, when I say raise your left hand, everyone raise your left hand. Okay. So you know what, that's experiment number one, right? And then, you know what, experiment two, if I say raise your right hand, then everyone raise your right hand. Okay, so you know what, just bear with me a little bit. Okay, everyone raise your left hand. Okay, please. So done, right? Everyone is done, right? So you know, if everyone only wants to raise their left hand, just takes one step. So everyone raise your right hand. Yeah, right hand, that's right. Okay, done. So now, in your mind, roll a dice. Okay, roll a dice. And decide whether you want to raise your left hand or you raise left hand or raise your right hand. Okay, roll a dice. Have you decided? I have no idea what you decided, but make sure you decided, right? Everyone who decided to raise your left hand, raise your left hand. Everyone who decided to raise your right hand, raise your right hand. You see, it takes twice as long to go through all of you, okay? And Now we can extend it into your left foot, left leg and the right leg, right? So we can have two different combinations. Everyone who decided to raise your left hand and the left leg, raise, you know, right? So that's one pass, right? And then everyone who wants to raise your left hand and right leg, now we have four passes, okay? Silly thing, but that's exactly what the hardware does, okay? So, you know what? Then, so this is really where the additional execution time comes from, okay? It takes additional cycles to be able to actually let each opinion, okay, go through. And for those of you who want to be professors, who want to be, you know, department heads and so on, you know, this is a kind of a you know, a little bit of an advice for you, okay? So when you run a department, you know, one of the things that professors like to do is to voice their opinion, okay? So we all like to talk, we all have our own opinions, you know, we all roll a dice whether we want our left hand or right hand, almost doesn't matter, it may just depend on our mood of that day. So when you have these departmental decisions to make, you know what, you always have to have this meeting where everyone who wants to raise their left hand will have a chance of saying why they want to raise their left hand. Everyone who wants to raise their right hand have a chance to talk about why they want to raise their right hand, and you spend the whole day talking, and then eventually you make a decision that you want to make to begin with, right? So, but it's very important that everyone gets to talk about their left hand and their right hand, okay? So, you know what, if you follow this advice, you will do well as a department head, you know, or as whatever, you know what. So, you know, you may thank me one day. You know, this may even be the most beneficial thing that you will have from this course. Not any of the CUDA programming, but, you know, how to actually make your people happy. So, the common case is that you want to avoid divergence when branch condition is a function of thread ID. So, a very good sign of branch divergence is when you look at your code, okay, when you look at your if-then-else statement, you start to see something that, you know, when the condition that you're testing is somehow determined, okay, somehow determined by your thread ID. So that's the most obvious sign. So, you know, for example, if you have a branch that says thread ID X is greater than 2, okay, then you know what, you have branch divergence. But the divergence is a little bit subtle here. The divergence will only happen within the first warp of every block. Right, because once you go beyond the first warp, all the thread IDs are going to be greater than 2, right? So for all the warps beyond that first warp, all the threads will only want to take the then part. So that is correspond to the fact that the entire class all want to raise their right hand, okay? And when that happens, even though the code appears to have a then part and else part, as long as all the threads in a warp wanted to just go to one of the directions, the hardware only requires one pass. Okay, it doesn't take multiple paths. So that's how you avoid, you know, paying the performance penalty even though you have a decision. Does that make sense? Okay. So, you know what? So this creates two different control paths for threads, you know, in a block, and you know what, the branch granularity is really less than warp size, and you know what, essentially thread 0 and thread 1 will follow a different path than the rest of the, you know, the threads. And if you have a branch condition that is, you know what, based on thread ID divided by warp size greater than 2, that means, you know what, the thread IDs are more than 2 times of the warp size, okay? So what does this mean? This means that you're sorting the threads in a block into two categories. The ones that belong in the first 2 warps and the ones that are belong to the rest of the warps, right? And when you do this, all the threads in the warp will fall into the same category, right? Okay, because you're sorting on a warp basis. So that allows you to not have any divergence in any of the warps, because for each warp, you will be all taking one direction or the other direction. There's no need to take multiple passes. Make sense? Okay. Nadi.
Is it, you know, if I have an if statement, I go this way, right. Else I go this way.
Yeah.
What if I have, like a hammock? So if Fahrenheit is even at one, and Fahrenheit is odd at two, then we go back to the same place.
Yes.
Is that still considered a divergence?
Okay, so the question is, you know what, I kept talking about, you know, one goes one way and the other goes another way, but don't they eventually come back together, and then, you know, do they still consider branch divergence? That's exactly right. That's still divergence. So, you know what, that's the part. Actually, thank you for asking that question, because all these things hopefully will eventually come back to the same point. And so when I talk about these multiple passes, they will actually, you know, be taken. The passes are going to be taken from the point that you diverge, and then to the point where you're going to reconverge. And that reconvergence point is going to be the stopping point of all these passes. But still, you have a divergence because you're taking multiple paths in between. Okay? Very good. So let's kind of take an example where, you know what, you'll be doing the same thing. You're going to have the same number of if then else. But by, you know, changing the way that you actually operate, or changing the order of, you know, how you operate, you can actually have less divergence effect or more divergence effect. Yes, Wally.
You know, you can talk about the branch granularity. The idea is not sort of like, you know, parallelism granularity, because here you really don't care, as long as all threads in the same orb go in the same direction.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So as long as the granularity is greater than warp size, you are okay.
Yes. So while he's saying that, you know what, he's thinking about this in terms of the granularity. You know,
the use of the term granularity.
Yeah.
Not the same, right?
Yes. So the question is, you know, is this granularity related to the kind of the parallelism granularity? And they're actually quite separate. So, you know, this has to do with how many of those threads make the same decision, right? Okay. Good. So you know what? This is one of the examples where, you know, we're going to actually expose some of the interesting subtleties in parallel processing. Okay, so I'm going to use the opportunity to talk about performance. I'm also going to use the opportunity to talk about some of the more subtle considerations when you try to, you know, do parallel programming, you know, based on these algorithms. So let's say, you know, reduction, you know, given an array of values, reduce them to a single value in parallel. And many of you have, you know, experience with reduction. You know, one of the reduction that you can make is to find the total, okay, of a large number of items, right? So that's a reduction. You take a large number of, you know, items, and you reduce them eventually to the total sum, right, of all the values. That's the obvious reduction. Another reduction is maximal. Okay, so you take a large number of items, and eventually you find the biggest one, right? And we do reduction. In fact, the world is crazy about reduction. You know what? If you don't believe me, you know what? The world has this World Cup, right? You know what? Every 4 years or something, right? And you know what? You start with a huge number of soccer teams, right? And you know what? What do you do? Eventually, you have a champion, right? That's maximum, okay? And you know what? There are various ways you can do these kind of reductions, okay? You can do serial reduction, you can do parallel reduction. So the serial reduction goes the follow, okay? You can start from your first element, right? You can start your first element. And then you go in every, you go visit every element, right? And if that element is bigger than the one that you have in hand, you throw away what you have and then get the bigger one. And you go through them, right, one by one. And in the end, when you reach the very end, whatever you have on hand should be the maximum. Make sense? It's a very simple mechanism, right? And you can implement this by having, something like, line up all the teams in the world, in the World Cup, right? And you let me pick my friends, so let's get Jordan team to start. And then Jordan will visit Korea, and boom, 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 boom. And then, the winner comes to Japan, and then dum 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 dum. And then you go to China, and then dum 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 dum. So whoever survives, go to the next one, right? And by the time you traverse through all the countries, the last team that stands, right, is the champion, right? So that's one algorithm. If you have, 100, countries, it takes 100 of these serial steps, right, for you to actually reach the championship. And it's usually a little too long, and people don't like that, right? So people use parallel reduction. Parallel reduction works the following. You have all these, elements lined up, and then you have, each neighbor to, right? So all the neighbors fight, and then the winner of each pair advance, right? So now you, in one step, you have eliminated half of your contenders, right? And that's a very, very powerful mechanism. That's the reason why all these tournaments can work in short period of time. You make sure that in every step, NFL, all these guys do the same thing. In every step, you eliminate half of your contenders. Advance, another half, right? So what's the catch here? The catch is that you need to have a lot of soccer fields. If you want to be able to eliminate, let's say, half of your 100 teams in one step, you need to be able to support 50 games at the same time in order to do that, right? So that's parallel processing. That's the fundamental reason why for World Cup kind of things, they don't really go to the final competition until somewhat late. They actually have regional kind of stuff going on. And that's where they eliminate, okay? That's where they get lots and lots of soccer fields spread all over the world. And every step, they can eliminate half of the contenders until the number of teams become manageable for a particular country to host, okay? And then you go into that country, and then you pull up all the good soccer fields, and that's where you do the final elimination, right? So the reduction algorithm here works exactly the same way, okay? If you have, let's say, a million elements that you need to reduce, right? So what you do is you have the thread blocks to each reduce within a segment. And then you can take, then you do the second kernel and actually take all the elements that survived the first phase. And then add another kernel, another block to reduce it. So you have hierarchical reduction. So what we're going to show here is one of those steps where you're taking one of the segments and having the threads in a block, okay, to reduce that segment of elements, right? Okay. So typically in the parallel implementation, if you do this, you essentially half the elements in every step. And therefore, if you have n elements, you'll end up with log n steps. If you have 1,000 elements, you only need to take 10 steps. If you have 1,000,000 elements, you take 20 steps. And it's a very, very efficient way of dealing with large amount of data, right? So if you have, 4 billion elements,
no sweat, 32 steps. Okay, so as long as you have enough execution resources, as long as you have enough soccer fields, you know what? We can grow the number of teams by 4 times at only 2 more steps. Isn't that great? So 400 teams, just, you know, 2 more TV slots and we're done, right? So you know what? It's a very good business model in many ways, right? Okay. So let's say, you know what, if we're going to do a vector reduction, and you know, let's assume that we're going to do something called in-place reduction, meaning that you know what, we're going to store all the elements in memory, but and then when we do the advancement, instead of generating the new pairwise sum of champions in other memory locations, we just go and overwrite some of the elements in the original storage. And this is called in-place algorithm. It's very popular because it takes less amount of memory to operate. And so when you have a huge amount of data, oftentimes people like to do in-place algorithms because the amount of storage does not grow as bad as if you copy the data around, okay, all the time. So you know what? So we're going to use the shared memory to hold a partial sum vector. So the shared memory is going to actually, you know what? So every thread block is going to have a chunk of shared memory that is going to store all the elements that is responsible for reducing, right? So you know what? I want you to keep that sort of the big picture in your mind, where you know if you have, let's say, billions of elements, then you're going to actually chop them up right into segments, and each block is going to be reducing that one segment in the shared memory. Okay, so that, you know what, just kind of keep that picture in mind. And the final solution will eventually go into element zero. So essentially what you're going to do is you're going to have, you know, let's say up to 512 of these elements laid out in the shared memory, and the threads will begin to, you know, to produce the reduction. In the first step, the threads will generate the pairwise champions in the even elements. Okay. So after the first pass, the champions will be in the even elements because, you know, only one out of each pair will survive. So you can pick even or odd, right? And then the next phase, the 4-element champions will go into the multiple of 4 positions, right? And then so on. And eventually everything will go into element 0, right? And that's where you're done, okay? So the code is fairly simple, okay? Let's say we declare the partial sum array. So this is that in place, you know, shared memory data structure. So we declare that into the shared memory. And then we according to the thread ID, you know what, every thread is going to, you know, to pick the particular element to work on, you know, at every time step, right? So that you know for in each step, you know, which part of the segment that you're going to be dealing with, right? That's how the parallelism works. So you know, you're going to define a variable called stride. And this stride essentially defines the size of the champion group that you're dealing with in every step of the way. Remember, in the first step, you're going to have pairwise champions, right? So the stride is 1 because, you know what, the comparison is between an element and the element plus 1 position. Okay, so that's a stride 1. The next step, remember, all the survivors are now in the even locations, right? So the comparison will be made between an element and the position plus 2 now. So that stride should become 2 in the second step. And you have step of 4 in the next step, stride of 4 in the next step, because now you're going to be comparing with 1 element and the element 4 away, right? Or 3 away, depends on how you count. So we have this stride. We start with 1, not 4 away. So in every iteration what we're going to do is we're going to actually multiply the stride by 2. So we're going to just raise it along the powers of 2, you know, in every step. At each step, we're going to do two things. We're going to first synchronize. Why are we synchronizing? Because we want to make sure that in every step, remember, every step operates on the survivors from the previous step, right? So you need to make sure that all the survivors have been written into that place. So you need to make sure that all the threads have finished their first step, previous step, before you can go to the next step. So you sync threads first. And then you say, if my thread ID is 2 times stride, then I perform this partial sum. Why is that? Because, you know what, for every pair of element, you only need to have one thread working on it, right? So in the first iteration, or first step, you need to have half of the elements, you know what, the number of threads equal to the half of the number of elements to work on each pair. And then when you go to the next step, okay, you only need to have one half of those threads, because now you have only half of the elements left. So you can half the number of threads that you need in order to, you know, to do the partial sum of the next step. So this actually exposes an interesting criticism that a lot of people have on CUDA. Okay. When you look at this kernel, okay, you have a situation where more and more and more of the threads decide to do the else part, which is nothing. Make sense? Because when you launch a kernel, you need to determine the exact number of threads in the grid, in the block, so the thread configuration is fixed when you launch the kernel. This is called a static kernel configuration. It's static in the sense that as soon as you launch the kernel, you can no longer change the number of threads involved in that kernel. You like them or not, they're always going to be there until you terminate the kernel. So all you can really do is to make sure that some of these threads do nothing, right? So in a situation like this, as you progress in your computation, you are putting more and more of these threads into inactivity, right? Rather than shrinking the number of threads that you have in the system, right? And that actually can have some negative implications on your performance. And that's the reason why, if you look at OpenMP and then, you know, and thread building block, they all have some mechanism for these parallel kernel type of things to dynamically readjust the number of threads rather than resorting to putting the threads into inactivity. And that's called dynamic thread organization. Okay, CUDA does not support dynamic organization at this point, but it's conceivable at some point they may start to support it, because there are algorithms that have this kind of behavior. Even worse, in some situations, you may have algorithms that require more threads as you discover more work. So, you know, we're looking at a direction where you have fewer and fewer threads active in your algorithm. But in a lot of situations, you may actually have a situation where you work into a problem, you start to find more and more work, okay? And then you regret that you don't have enough threads to be able to handle all that work. So that's why, you know what, at some point, you can probably expect that CUDA will support some of these more dynamic thread organizations. Yes?
How about you need to relaunch your kernel with a new number of threads?
Yes. So the question is, how bad would it be to relaunch your kernel with a bunch of threads? The answer is not that bad. That's part of the reason why, you know, CUDA is still, you know, staying with this static structure, because the kernel launching overhead is not as bad as some of the, some of the higher, higher overhead CPU style kind of, organizations. And that's part of the reason why you see that in the CPU parallel computation, ever since day one, they have this kind of support because they don't want to go into the high overhead launching and relaunching of these things. Yes, John?
So in this situation, and actually in most situations, it's not the kernel launch overhead that matters. It's the fact that between kernel launches, you have to dump everything to global memory. So it's not much that you have the overhead of launching another kernel of different block size. That's not a big deal. The problem is that to get data from one kernel to the next, you have to dump, spill everything into global memory and then load it all back. So you're basically killing your bandwidth.
So what John is saying, just kind of for the recording, is that, remember, shared memory contents are only valid through the lifetime of the thread blocks. So if you terminated your kernel and then launch another kernel, you're starting new thread blocks. So if you have some data that you want to preserve from one kernel to the next kernel, then you need to dump all your useful information out to the global memory and read them back. And oftentimes, that's a very time-consuming part of the process. Yes, Wally.
I mean, this does not really slow the computation. I mean, you are doing the best you ever can by doing good execution. I mean, so what?
Okay. So Wally's question is, this doesn't really slow the execution because you're doing as fast as you can. And the answer is yes or no. It depends on how careful you are. So that goes to the next slide. Okay.
Very good question. We can reach to that.
So let's. Yes.
Can you like declare like shared memory like static or something like that?
No.
No. So the question is, can you declare a shared variable as static? The answer is no, because that would require a hardware implementation that kind of sneak the data out of the shared memory and then load them back in, in a transparent way. And that's not supported at this point. Okay. So vector reduction with not band conflict, but branch divergence. So we're going to correct that. So let's say we do the array, we're doing the reduction. So remember, the algorithm is in place. So what we're really doing is we're taking the elements, and then we're overriding elements 0 and 2 and 4 in the first step, and then we override 0 and 4 and 8 in the second step. But making things a little bit more readable, we kind of unravel that process and show the same memory storage in two time steps. So these are not data copying. These are really time snapshots of the same data structure as you move forward. Okay. So So in the first step, we take the pairwise, and then we add them together, or we championship whatever. And the second one, we take the survivors and we do the pairwise, and then we take more and more of the survivors and then do the addition. So if you look at the code, the original code, you're going to have all these threads, and the threads are going to use their thread IDs, right, to determine where in that shared memory they're going to be operating on. And also, the if statement is going to put some of the threads into inactivity. So even from the first iteration, you only have half of the threads, right, active. So it may or may not be immediately clear to you when you look at that piece of C code, right? But if you start to think about it, even from the very beginning, you're losing half of your threads to inactivity. And then you have, the next step, you're going to have only, so you're going to have even smaller number of threads. In this, the second step, you're going to have only the multiples of four threads that will be active, okay? So more and more of the threads are being kind of swept into the inactive path.
So, you know what, why does it matter? Because what happens, remember you have a warp, okay, you have a warp. And whenever you put the warp into execution, you're going to have, you know, all the warps are going to be executing, but some of them, remember this left hand and right hand thing. So fewer and fewer of the threads in a warp are producing, okay, whenever you put the warp into that schedule, into the hardware. And also there will be additional overhead just for the hardware to be able to say, oh, I have a then part, I have the else part. Even though the else part is essentially doing nothing, you still need to do a little bit of nothing in the hardware in order to implement that nothing path. So these two add to the execution time of your, you know, of your code. So, you know, basically, you know, to summarize, you will say, in each iteration, two control flow paths will sequentially traverse. Threads perform addition and threads do not. And threads that do not perform addition may cause extra cycles depending on the implementation of divergence. But more importantly, you know, the productive threads in each warp gets less and less and less. So, you know what, I don't know if you have participated in a, you know, in these, rowboat races. And you know what, when you get to the end of the race, you know what, you start to have, you know, double effect. Each of you will be more tired, and some of you will actually begin to just not row, right? So you can really feel that effect when you have fewer and fewer people rowing that boat. And this is essentially what it is, okay? You are going to have less and less progress every time a warp is scheduled into that into the hardware execution unit. So right from the beginning, you know, you have half of the threads. And on average, if you look through the lifetime, less than one quarter of the threads will be activated in for all the warps. And after the fifth iteration, entire warps in the block will be disabled. So, you know what, that's actually good news. So, you know, after the fifth block, you know what, you would begin to have some of the warps that are actually, you know what, not going to participate at all. That's when you actually have less divergence. You have everything raising the left hand or everything raising the right hand. But that's not going to be very good because you're actually going to only take a few more steps, okay? Before you reach the very end. So that, you know, that good window is not going to help you a whole lot. Up to four more iterations where each iteration will have just, you know, one thread activated until all the warps retire. So now, if you make a minor change to your code, you can actually eliminate much of the negative effect. So what we're saying is that, you know, instead of doing this pairwise thing, if we divide up all the elements into two halves, first half and the second half, and we always do the elimination across halves, okay, so that we, in the first half, every element will be competing with the element, corresponding element in the other half, okay? Then we can actually have a situation where we have the entire warp to be always active all the way to the very end, but we have fewer and fewer warps participating, okay? As soon as you finish the first half, half of your warps will be out of the picture, okay? So the inactive threads are still going to be the same. It hasn't changed. But the inactive threads are all lumped into the same warp. That's the key, okay? Why does it matter? Because when you have such a situation, all the active warps are going to be fully productive,
Okay, and also it only takes one pass through the productive warps. So every time these productive warps gets scheduled into the hardware, all the 8 elements will be producing useful results. That's how you can make fast progress. So rather than having twice the number of warps, each one producing half of the capacity, you have half of the warps, but each one producing full capacity. So this is the law of having good employees. It's always better to have half of the employees, but everyone is doing the work, rather than having twice the employee and everyone is doing half of the work. If you ever need to hire anyone, you know that works, right? Okay? Exactly the same way here. So synchronize, so when you go through the steps, now the stride works slightly differently, okay? The stride, remember, goes across the two loops, two halves. So the stride will start with half of the size of the data structure, right? So that you can reach to the corresponding part of the other half. So the stride will start with a big number, which is half of the data size. And then in every step, you will actually reduce the stride by half, because you will be writing all the champions, right, into your first half. So you take the two halves, you do the comparison, and then you write all the champions into the first half. And then you chop that first half into two halves again, meaning one quarter each part. So now you're comparing across these two quarters. So the stride is going to be one quarter of the original data structure, data size. So you will see this, you know what, your reduction and stride multiplied by 2?
That is the same code as
the last. Wait, what happened to the change? Oh, shortcoming. I'm going too fast. So, you know, the slide actually was what I already talked about. You know, you have a bad divergence in the branch. So a better implementation starts the stride, okay, with the block dimension, and then in every iteration you would divide by 2. And dividing by 2 is the same as left shifting by 1 bit in the binary numbers. So as long as the stride is still greater than 1, you know you have more work to do. But as soon as the stride equals 1, you know that you have finished the last pair. Okay? Now, in the algorithm, you still need to do sync threads, because every step, you're still operating on the survivors from the previous step. It's just that the survivors are now all packed into the first part, right? And then into the thread, into the step, you will see if your thread ID is less than the stride size. In the first step, the stride size is half of your data structure size. So if your thread ID is less than that, then you're doing the comparison. But if it's greater than that, it's in that second part that you don't need to do any work. So even though you are, you know what, still wasting half of the threads, but those threads are all going to be lumped into the same warp, and they all got lumped into the retirement home, and they're not, you know, hopefully not consuming any resources. In the university system, you know what, I'm not going to say this, it's on the recording. So, you know what, so we have, you know, still the partial sum will be, you know what, done with the stride. But remember, this stride is not a far-reaching, you know, number. Right, so you are reaching to the other part of the world and then do that addition. So if we picturize the thing, you know what, we have, you know, the data structure, and then we have, you know what, essentially every survivor is one element and the corresponding element on the other half, but you keep producing these dense structures. Okay, you keep producing these dense structures and the dense thread configuration for you to, you know, operate. So here's some observations about the new implementation. It turns out that you're still going to have some divergence. It's not going to be all gone. Because when you get into the last five steps, you're going to have fewer than 32 elements. So as soon as you get into that range, you're going to necessarily have divergence within that warp. Some of the warps in those 32 threads will begin to become inactivated. So when you get small enough of these elements, you will be in a situation where you will not be able to, you will not be able to avoid, divergence. And you said, oh, that's only five iterations, right? But you have to look at it from the log point of view, because you may be starting with only 1,000 elements in a warp, because you start with 512 threads, right? So you can start with 1,000 elements to start so that you can fully utilize the 500 threads. You need to change your code a little bit to get that efficiency. But 1,000 elements only require 10 steps. So what that means is that you're only going to have, five iterations without divergence and five iterations divergence. So in terms of steps, you really just eliminated half of your divergence. However, you eliminated divergence for many, many, many warps. So that's the good part. Okay, that's the good part. The second one is the entire warps will be shut down as iterations progress. So for a 512 thread block, four iterations will shut down all but one warp in the block. And this actually is a very good utilization of the resources, because those warps no longer consume execution resources. Okay, they don't need to go into floating point units and so on. So those floating point units are now available to other thread blocks that are making warps that need to make progress. Okay. So now, here's some subtleties. Yes, Wally.
Quantitative, hitting how much is overhead is, divergence overhead.
Uh-huh.
There are any measurements how much.
It's something that you can measure. I don't think they really tell you. So it is significant. You can really see it. Yeah. So it's something easy to measure. Just run the two code and you will see the difference. So, before I go into yes. So let's say, all of you are smart people, okay? So how many of you went to the Need for Speed seminar we had this week? How many of you? Good. So at dinner, Keith Auburn, would talk to us, and we thank him for coming down to Champaign and all that. He said, I always like to come to Champaign. Why? You like the 57 drive? No, that's not the point. So the point is, he says, he truly feels that, Champaign is one of the places where you have the highest density of smart people in the world. Okay, so, when we have a class like this, we probably have more brain power than some of the, some of the thousand people organization or something. So, all of you are going to be thinking, okay, and then, say, aha! I have some good ideas. This professor who, he talks about these ideas, but I have better ideas. And that's exactly the attitude you should have. Okay, you should be thinking about better ideas. Okay, and you should think about how you can do better than anyone else. So so let's say John looks like a smart guy. So he look at the code and say, I have a great idea here. He makes the observation that the last six loops, the iterations, only one warp is going to be active, right? So then you can all the writes into the shared memory. Remember, this is within the same warp, right? After when you get to the last five iterations, all the threads are going to be in the warp. So John says, I know this machine in and out. I know exactly how that works. So, you know, if you think about it and say, okay, I only have one warp going, so all the 32, up to 32 threads will be executing exactly at the same time. I know exactly where they are in the machine every time they go and execute. So, you know, in the previous code, I have the sync thread in every iteration. Okay, I have the sync thread for every iteration. And you know what? That's kind of silly, okay? You know what? Why do I want to take that overhead when I know that all these threads are going to be acting exactly together? The synchronization is only needed when you are not sure that everyone will be together, okay? So let me give you one example, okay? I'm on a roll giving these examples. Remember those bus tours, right? So remember the bus driver, what the bus driver do. After all the passengers supposed to return, he take out the list and he count the people four times, okay? And make sure that everyone is on the bus, okay? Before the bus drives away. And sometimes you even need to be a little more careful than that, because you may end up with the same passengers, but you know what, a different person somehow. Okay, you never know, right? So there are all kinds of these overheads that you need to do in order to do that barrier synchronization. So here is a great idea. The bus driver got really tired of this. So he went and bought a whole bunch of handcuffs. And then, you know what, so he would just chain up all the passengers with handcuffs, okay? So you know what, I'll be chained up with John. John will be chained up, what's your name?
Sal.
Sal, right? And then, what's your name?
David.
Sal and David would be chained up. So you know, everyone gets all chained up, right? So then the bus driver lets them go to the do the tourist thing. So everyone would just walk with the chain, right? So you know what, then by the time the group comes back, the bus driver doesn't need to count anymore, right? Because the handcuffs are supposed to have worked, right? So everyone will be guaranteed to come back together. There's a little bit of cost to this, right? You know, when you go to the bathroom, it's gonna be a little bit inconvenient. But you know, that's the branch divergence problem, okay? Anyway, so you know, when you do this, you say, okay, so I already know that all these things are gonna be in the same warp. So every time they go into execution, they're all gonna be executing the same instruction at exactly the same time. So instead of doing synchronization all the way through, I'm going to do the synchronization until I know that they have reached that one warp point. For the rest of the code, instead of doing a loop, which is also, you know, kind of, you know, cumbersome, I just list all the five iterations, okay, out. So that there's not a loop overhead. My code is so efficient now, right? There's not even a branch instruction. I eliminated a bunch of these overhead. So, you know what? So it's like, okay, now I eliminated all the branch overhead, but I still need to do my thread ID. But I know, you know what? This is nothing new. You know, I'll have fewer and fewer threads, you know, going. So now, you know what? When you do the first iteration, remember you're producing the survivors, right? You're producing the survivors. But you don't need a synchronization when you do the second step, because you know everyone in that warp will be doing the same instruction at the same time. So they would have all finished with this instruction before they can move on to the next instruction. So John, with his precise knowledge about the machine and all the lectures he had heard me over and over again in the past 2 years, he figured out that there's no need to insert synchronization between these statements. Okay? It's very lean, mean code, right? And that's a bad idea, right? That's a very bad idea. He's being too smart for his own good. The reason is, now you're assuming that the warp size is 32, right? So if the warp size ever become 16, right? Then suddenly, this instruction will be executed across two warps. And there's no guarantee that some instructions in the other warp will have been done before you try to do this next instruction in your current warp. So that's how things start to break. And this is a concrete example, of not having to use the warp size to guarantee the execution, the correctness of the execution. Having abused John so much, he's one of the guys who originally said, no, don't do this kind of stuff. Okay, so he's actually the good guy who caught these kind of problems. Yes?
And actually, it's even worse than that, because if you pilot this kind of CUDA code for an architecture besides a GPU, the assumption that you even have warps might be gone. So I don't write code like this primarily because I write the tools that compile CUDA code for other architectures, and I don't want to write code.
And it's going to break. It's definitely going to break in your code.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yeah, in your tool.
I don't write code that breaks my tools.
Okay. So that's the summary of what we just said. We are pretty much done, but I wanted to sort of just give you a little bit of a sense of sometimes how the compiler tries to help with the branch divergence problem. So, you know what, if there's some predicate execution, okay? So, in the typical way of doing these decisions in the program, we have these, essentially if then else implemented in conditional branch, right? So you have conditional branch go away or you continue. So, you know what, that's the classical decision. But there are also some, another way of looking at it, and it's called predicate execution, meaning that you can have each instruction to carry another variable. Okay, the variable can be true or false. Okay, and if the variable is true, then the instruction will execute normally. It will execute and write into the register file. Okay, and if the instruction, if the variable is false, then the instruction will become a no-op. This is actually already implemented in the machine because of the branch divergence problem. Remember, when you have a warp where some of the instructions want to go one path and the other one, when you take these passes, some of the threads cannot write into their output state or registers or memory location. So the hardware that is required to implement something like this is already there. So what they did is they say, okay, let's make that available to individual instructions rather than all the instructions that are being executed in each thread. So let's make it explicitly available to the compiler or even to the programmer if you like, that individual instructions can go and read a variable and decide if instructions should take effect or not effect. Okay? So now, with this capability, if you have something like an if and else, in the original code, what you need is you need to be able to have a conditional branch that branch around from that C+1. However, with predicated execution, what happens is that you do the comparison. You generate that comparison condition and write it into a variable, P1. And then all the next three instructions that implement C+1 will all carry that variable. So you will execute this piece of code, okay? And only if P1 is of one value would these instructions write into their registers, okay, and take effect. If P1 is zero, then none of them will take any effect. So it's as if they never existed. So with this, you will not see any conditional branch in your code. And the hardware will never have to activate the multiple pass kind of mechanism. The hardware just assumes that it's going through a single pass. It's just that some of the threads have disappeared from underneath that hardware because they individually decide whether they will take effect or not. Okay, so this is the general concept of predicated execution. So, when you have an if and else, then what you can do is you can generate a condition, you can carry the condition in the B bar, and then you can carry the complement of that condition value in the else part, okay? And then you can suddenly just
mix B and C all the way into A and D. And that allows you to have a straight line code, okay? And you have a mixture of instructions, but the instructions all carry their own, you know, suicide order, essentially, right? So in the cases where the condition is true, then only the B instructions that came from B will eventually write into to their state. If the condition is false, only the C will write into their state. But as far as that divergence hardware is concerned, nothing gets triggered, okay? This thing has its own cost, because even though you're doing one pass, if you actually have a large number of instructions, okay, from both paths, suddenly you need to process through many more instructions. So this is the most valuable when one of the paths, okay, or the frequent path is much bigger than the infrequent path, or when both paths are very small, then the overhead of fetching a small number of instructions every time you go through it is actually better than trying to branch around and do the multiple paths. So the compiler that NVIDIA provides use that kind of heuristic to determine if some of these conditional constructs can actually be, you know, converted into the, you know, well, into the form. And the heuristic is usually that whenever you have a, you know, a situation, then you know that it's going to diverge, then you only predicate if the both paths together add up to less than 7 instructions. Remember, if you have a lot more instructions, you can actually start to, you know, to lengthen your execution path with all those additional instructions. But if you know that it's not guaranteed to diverge, then you need to have even fewer instructions to even consider this. So this actually tells you a little bit about the hardware, the cost that they believe that the divergence hardware, you know, introduces. Okay? So, you know, all the predicated instructions will take execution cycles, but they will not trigger the divergence hardware. If you're interested in this whole topic, it turns out that I spent years of my life working on this kind of technology. And, you know, my group produced the predicated execution technology for Intel, the Intel Itanium system. And then, you know, NVIDIA also used this technology into their compiler, you know, implementation. So if you're interested, there's a paper that you can look at, and you know, you can actually see a lot of the intricacies if you're interested. So that's pretty much what I want to say about you know, control flow, divergence, and you know what, intricacies of warps, and you know what, any addition, announcement, anything before the due date tomorrow, John?
Relating to the MP, no, I don't think so.
Okay, so in that case, good luck with MP, and start with the next MPs right away after you take 1 hour of break or something, okay? So see you next week.